Hey folks, so here's text, right? Don't worry about it. Throw it inside somewhere. Don't leave it on stack there. Okay, so here's what's going to happen. The quizzes will get picked up in a couple of minutes by the TAs, who are going to put it in alphabetical order. No questions right now. The quizzes are going to be put in alphabetical order. And then I'm going to start grading it probably right after this class is over. Can I have your attention, please? Good, thank you. So I will grade them, and when I'm done grading, I will send you an email saying your quizzes are done, come and pick them up. They will be face down on the 9th floor of KMAC, right outside the finance department. I'll give you in alphabetical order. That's why I asked you to write your name in the back. If you did not, I will write your name in for you, but no, it's just, that's part of the reason the name on the back goes in, because it is in alphabetical order. Please don't browse. Right, just pick up your damn exam. Don't look at other, you know where your name is in the alphabet. So unless you got really confused between now and then, you should be able to get your exam out. And I will send the solution with my grading template. Please check the grading, because I do screw up. And so if I mess up, you know, bring it to my attention, I'll fix it. In fact, all you need to do is take a picture of the page, take my solution and say, look, it looks like you missed something. And sometimes it's because you've written all over the page and I just completely lost track of where you were going and I got tired and moved on. So just let me know if I've messed up. I know that this is asymmetric. You know what I mean by that, right? If I've made mistakes in your favor, there's zero chance once in a while though, I do get somebody saying you gave me too many points. But usually the mistakes are all going to be in your direction. That's okay, right? So you will get the quizzes back. I prefer not to give grades on the first quiz because it's 10%. And remember, your worst quiz gets thrown away. But I'll send you the distribution. If you want to reverse engineer from the distribution what you think your grade is, okay, then I'm okay with that. But I will send you the distribution. But you will hear back sooner than you think, okay? So that's just before I leave the quiz. There are a couple of things that I think I hope stick. Right? When you divest something, you know, as a business, when you divest something, what happens to your debt to equity ratio?
Nothing
happens yet, right? Because when you divest something, what happens? You sell something, cash comes in. I need to tell you what happens to the cash before you can tell me what happens. If I do nothing with the cash, if I leave it on the balance sheet, nothing happens to the debt to equity ratio. Now, once I decide to do something with the cash, then I'm going to tell you, I'm going to do a buyback, which does what? What does it affect, debt or equity? It'll reduce my equity. If I pay a special dividend, it'll reduce my equity. If I pay down debt, it'll reduce my debt. That's why the action itself is not what you should be looking for. It's the action and the consequence. When I acquire another company, what happens to my debt to equity ratio? I have no idea until I tell you where I raised the money for the acquisition. Something that I hope sticks, because I see people talking about divestitures and acquisitions and automatically saying that must increase your debt to equity or decrease it. You cannot tell until you know what the financing mix is. So what I'd like to do today is cement in the last of the hurdle rate discussion. So if you remember, I left you with the betas and costs of equity for Disney, where I used the bottom-up beta. I came up with the beta and the cost of equity for each of the five divisions. I want you to take a look at those costs of equity, because I'm now going to present you with what I think is one of corporate finance's first principle questions. Let's see if you can apply it. So you got different costs of equity, so the different divisions, and you got a cost of equity for the company. I'm now going to ask you to be the CFO of Disney, And I'm going to be the movie guy at Disney, and I'm going to come up with a project. And I want you to tell me, based on those costs of equities I computed in the previous page, whether you will take this project or not. So let's give the project a name. Lone Ranger 2. This time, we're not using Johnny Depp. Somebody else. Lone Ranger 1 was one of the big flops of all time, right? They made spend $200 million in the movie. It made back only $35 million. So I'm the movie guy. We're making Lone Ranger 2. You're the CFO. It's a big budget movie. It's going to cost a couple of $100 million. And when I say the word Lone Ranger 2, you're already ready to shut the door on my face saying, get out of here. I'm not making it. But I say, this time we've looked at the numbers, which should tell you something about last time, but let's not go there. We've looked at the numbers and we think we can make a 9.5% return on equity. Let me be quite clear. No movie guy ever says these words. Return on equity is not something. But let's say I say, this time we've looked at the numbers and the return on equity is 9.5%. You're the CFO, you get to say yes or no on this. Do you see why I picked 9.5%? If we go back to the previous page, 9.5% is higher than the cost of equity for the company. But it is lower than the cost of equity for the movie business. So the real question I'm asking is, when I look at a project at Disney, should I be comparing the return on equity to the cost of equity for the company? Because after all, the company comes up with the money. Or should I be comparing it to the cost of equity of the business that that project is in? Anybody want to hazard a guess? Cost of equity for the company, cost of equity for the business. Yes. You think, okay, let's play it out. So if you decide to use the cost of equity for the company, you're going to use it for all five divisions, right? Okay, so not the company, but the business. Anybody want to disagree? Okay, so let's play it out. So if we decide to do that, then 8.52% is now going to be the cost of equity for all five businesses, right? Let's follow through. Which of these five businesses is now going to be happy about this choice I've made? And which of these five businesses is going to complain? Because remember, my businesses range from very safe to very risky. I'm now applying one cost of equity that's across the whole company, across the five businesses. Which of the five businesses are going to be happy about my choice and which ones are going to push back?
On its own, be able to make the hurdle rate.
Well, it's got nothing to do with the hurdle rate, safety and risk. The safe businesses are going to say, our hurdle rate should have been 7 point something. You're asking us to use 8.5%. And the risky business is going to say, this is great. You're giving us a lower cost of equity. So 5 years from now, when I look at this, what am I going to see in the company? Which businesses are going to have not just grown, but grown too much? And which businesses would have been starved for capital over that period?
The safe ones
are going to shrink. Eventually, they're going to go away. And the risky businesses are going to take over the company. And what's going to happen to my overall cost of equity as Disney? It's going to drift up. In a sense, what you've done is you've subsidized your risky businesses with your safe businesses' capital, right? That's basically what happens when you use an average cost of capital. And over time, your company will get riskier for all the wrong reasons. Do you see why it's the wrong reasons? By using 8.52% as my cost of equity for risky businesses, I'm charging too low a hurdle rate. They're taking projects they should not be taking. And this happens at every multi-business company that uses one cost of capital. And here's the bad news. Half of all companies in the world have one corporate hurdle rate. I've never understood how you get away with this, one corporate hurdle rate, when you have multiple businesses. And over time, they wonder why their company gets riskier. You know who the worst culprits on these are, on this dimension is? Who lectures other companies that they should do things right? It's investment banks, right? And during the between 2000 and 2008, here's what banks did. They played a return on equity game. Essentially, every player in the bank, every component, every business was required to deliver a return on equity, and the highest return on equity businesses won. Because remember, in banks, you have equity is a scarce resource, right? You got to decide where the equity is going to be invested. And if you think about money center banks, they were not just in banking, they were in investment banking, they were in trading, businesses with very different risk levels. Bankers Trust started the 1980s as a commercial bank. And by 1988, It was almost entirely an investment bank because it played this game. And finally, the commercial bankers just gave up. We can't compete with the returns that the riskier businesses are making, and we're subsidizing them. There are good reasons for growing your risky businesses, and there are bad reasons. This is a really bad one. If this is common sense that riskier businesses and projects should carry higher hurdle rates, why do you think so many companies insist on one corporate hurdle rate? What do you think their rationale is for sticking with one hurdle rate? One is they can say the money comes from my shareholders. They didn't, but your share, it's a shifting number, right? Your shareholders are going to reassess your company. So if you give them an 8.52% cost of equity now, and next year it becomes 8.5%. Remember, your projects have longer lives. So even if that is the rationale, eventually the truth is going to catch up with you, right? Your shareholders are going to wake up and say, you took all these risky projects to deliver less than we should. So if that's the reason, it's going to catch up with you. But let's think more pragmatically, and I'll give you an example, and you might be able to see why companies end up using one hurdle rate. The early 90s, somebody from this class had gone to work for The Gap. At that time, The Gap was a growing company, opening new stores all over the place. And they just started two new businesses. One was called The Limited, which was a Gap subsidiary, which sold Gap khakis at a 20% discount. And the other was Banana Republic, which is the Gap's clothes marked up 40%, but you don't have to deal with the riffraff. So now you have Gap, you've got The Limited, you got Banana Republic. Very different pricing strategies. So he gets into the Gap right when this process starts. And he's just taken the class. He's ready to try things out. And he calls me and he says, you know, we have three businesses. And based on what we talked about in class, I would not expect these three businesses. At that time, the Gap used an 18% hurdle rate for a typical Gap store. Typical Gap store was another mall store on a 12-year lease. So his reasoning was, no, the Gap has an 18% hurdle rate, but we now have two other businesses. One should have a lower hurdle rate and the other should have a higher one. So based on what we talked about last session about discretionary and non-discretionary, which of these three divisions should have the lowest hurdle rate and which one the highest? Limited should have the lowest hurdle rate because going for a low margin, high volume business, and Banana Republic should have the higher hurdle rate. I said, that's good thinking. He said, I'm planning to present it to the divisional heads next week. I knew exactly the buzzsaw he was going to walk into, but I didn't have the heart to tell him. I said, call me after you've done the presentation and tell me how it went. So he calls me right after the meeting and he says, it did not go well. He said, one of the divisional managers absolutely hated the idea. You know which one, right? The Banana Republic said, this is terrible. We're part of the Gap. Suddenly divisions discover they're part of the corporate family, the riskier divisions. He didn't like it. And I said, what did the CEO say? He said, the CEO views these divisions as his growth divisions. He didn't want to upset the manager too much. So he said, let's put off this discussion until next year. So one reason companies end up with one hurdle rate is the minute you start talking about different hurdle rates for different businesses, your riskier businesses push back. And often they're the high growth businesses that you want to nurture. So you decide not to rock the boat. This is exactly how banking, led investment banking and trading take over the enterprise. So one reason is that it is messy. There is going to be pushback and you need a management at the top that says, look, it's not about punishing or rewarding divisions. It's about making sure you earn a fair rate of return. Do you think Disney even considered the fact that Disney Plus should have a higher hurdle rate than Disney as a company? I think they should. It's a high growth business, a lot of infrastructure costs up front. You're spending huge amount. I'm not saying it's a good business or a bad business, but it should be put to a higher threshold than building another theme park, which you know exactly how to do. I don't think they did. You know why? Because Bob Chapek wanted to make Disney Plus the face of the company. So one reason you don't get this happening is because companies don't want to rock the boat. The other is very pragmatic. When I talked about betas, how did I say most people get betas? The way we were all taught. Run a regression, right? If that is your only way of estimating betas, you're trapped, right? Because how many betas are you going to get for Disney? You're going to get one beta for the entire company. If I asked you, what's the beta for Disney streaming? You're going to try to run a regression and come back and tell me, I can't run the regression. Why not? Because Disney streaming doesn't get traded separately. The businesses don't get traded. So the only way you get betas is from a regression. You're going to get one beta for every company. Can you imagine the nightmare that would have been GE? 26 different businesses, you take GE's beta and apply it across the board, you're asking for disaster. And maybe they did. Maybe that explains what happened at GE, is nobody was asking questions about differentiated risk. So the right thing to do, we know, is if you're a multi-business company, you should be assessing the risk of each business. And we know how to do it now. Look at other companies that are primarily in that business and come up with a cost of equity that varies across businesses and a cost of capital that varies across businesses, because that'll prevent the subsidization that'll happen otherwise. Any questions? Now let's complete the bottom-up beta process. And for the remaining companies, I'm going to speed through the process because you saw what I did for Disney. You don't want to see the insides of this because it's tiresome, it's tedious. I took Vale. Vale is a Brazilian mining company. Its biggest business is iron ore mining, but it's in other metals and mining. It's in fertilizers and it's also in the logistics business. Again, remember, this is not some secret pathway that I got to get this information. This came right out of the financials. I took the revenues they get from each business. So basically applied a multiple of revenues and an unlevered beta for each business. Here, I initially started with just Brazilian companies in my sample, but I very quickly gave up on that for two reasons. One is you're not going to get very many companies if you stay in a domestic market, especially one that's smaller. Second, who does Vale compete with in the iron ore mining business? Other iron ore mining companies around the world. These are commodity businesses and you're competing in a global marketplace. It doesn't even make sense for me to stay focused geographically on just Brazil or just Latin America. So I use global companies in each of these groups. And you can see the sample size is huge once you go global. There are 693 publicly traded fertilizer companies. I'm not going to complain about the law of large numbers here. I'm going to have large numbers working in my favor. There's my unlevered beta for each business. And the weights that I attach will be based on the estimated value. So this EV to sales comes from looking at publicly traded companies in each business. Based on my calculations, and I could be wrong on one or another dimension, the company is about 76% iron ore, about 16.7% mining, about 5.4% fertilizers, and about 1.8% logistics. In fact, right after I did this, Vale sold their logistics business. Imagine being tasked with valuing the logistics business. The advantage of doing a bottom-up beta is to value the logistics business. Now you're going to use a logistics beta, logistics cost of equity, and a logistics cost of capital. And the bottom table basically gives me my cost of equity and cost of capital. And you'll notice one difference from my Disney example. Notice that I didn't even bother trying to allocate debt across the businesses. First, Vale gave no sense of where the debt went. Second, these businesses are much closer to each other. Unlike Disney, where the movie business is very different from the theme park business. These are all big infrastructure businesses. They probably all call on debt. So I'm being sloppy. I'm applying the same debt to equity. If you want to finesse it, you can be my guest. It's not going to make that much of a difference, but you can see my cost of equity reflects the differences across businesses. But the case of Vale, the differences are much smaller because it's not as diverse a company as Disney is. So I've got dollar costs of equity and dollar based on those betas. Any questions? Let's say I get to this point, and maybe you get to this point on your project. Subtle nag that there is a project that you're supposed to be doing as we're going through. you come up with a dollar cost of equity for your Bolivian company or your Peruvian company, because you decide to do everything in dollar terms. Remember, currency is a choice. And then you say, you know what, I'd prefer to switch to the local currency. Remember the neat trick we talked about to convert from one currency to another? If you give me the cost of equity in US dollar terms, in this case, 11.23% for Vale, and you can give me the inflation rates in US dollars and Brazilian reais, 9% and 2%, I can convert. If you're in a hurry, just add the 7% difference to the 11.23%, you get an 18.23% cost of equity. Use that as a way of moving across currencies again, because it'll allow you to shift currencies late in the process. You don't have to redo the entire analysis. In fact, you could argue that perhaps you're better off doing a dollar number first, because all your risk premiums and default spreads were dollar-based anyway, and then doing this adjustment at the end, because it scales up everything for the difference in inflation. So any questions on the Vale calculation? So the mechanics are very similar. The only difference was I used the same debt to equity ratio for the different divisions. Let's talk about Tata Motors and Bayer. Tata Motors is an automobile company. I briefly considered breaking Tata Motors into two subgroups: mass market automobile, which is their history. Tata Motors cars in India were designed for the mass market, and luxury automobiles. Jaguar Land Rover is not a cheap car. And I very quickly gave up, because finding luxury auto companies, the companies that are pure luxury auto companies, it's kind of difficult to do. Maybe you can get a Ferrari, but Ferrari is not exactly like, we'll come back and talk about Ferrari later in the context story. I'm not even sure it's a car, to be quite honest. It's a very impractical car. It's a club. So I very quickly decided it wasn't worth the effort of breaking it down. So I decided to treat it as an auto company. Initially, I looked at only Indian automobile companies. Again, small sample size. And then I stepped back and said, it's an automobile company. Jaguar Land Rover is a big part of it. Why am I staying focused in India? So I looked at global automobile companies and I found 76. Some small, some big, some US, some Europe. I am comparing betas across different regions, but betas are scaled around one in every part of the world. The unlevered beta is 0.86. I did use Tata Motors tax rate and debt to equity ratio to come up with the levered beta. So the unlevered beta always comes from the industry, but the debt to equity and the tax rate to use for a company would reflect the company. There's my levered beta, and there's my rupee cost of equity. Remember when I said you got to the regression that from that point on, you're never going to use a regression beta again? These bottom-up betas are going to be the betas you see from this point on for these companies. I'm replacing the regression beta with these betas. And if you ask me why, it's more precise, it's more forward-looking, and I'm less likely to be using a beta that doesn't make sense for the company. And finally, for Biden, I looked at companies that derive their money from online advertising. Because, I mean, often I think we make the mistake of thinking of a business as what the company's platform looks like. I've seen people describe Facebook as a social media company. There is no such business as social media. You got to tell me how you make money on social media. And there are three ways you can make money. You can make money through advertising. Facebook, Twitter, at least for the moment, are basically advertising companies. What's the second way you can make money on social media?
Subscription.
You can make a subscription business, which is a different business model, or you can have a transaction business, where when people transact on your platform, you get revenues. Ultimately, you take all of the companies that have come out. You know, you can argue that all of these companies fall into one of these three groups. Some use a mix. You take Pandora, which is a music platform. It has subscriptions plus an ad model. In fact, you're hearing talk of Facebook introducing an ad model, so you can see mixes of these two. Baidu gets almost all of its revenues, at least in 2013, from advertising. As a consequence, I use online advertising companies. The unlevered beta is 1.30, much riskier business. And I use the tax rate and the debt to equity ratio for Baidu to come up with the levered beta. And the risk-free rate and the equity risk premiums come from the calculations we've done. Those don't change because I'm shifting to bottom-up betas. Which brings me to Deutsche Bank. Now, as I go through the calculation of a bottom-up beta for Deutsche Bank, I want you to notice what I'm doing differently than all of my other companies. I broke Deutsche Bank into two businesses, commercial banking, it's primarily in Europe, and investment banking, which is all over the world. For commercial banking, I used European commercial banks. So I don't even know why that top thing is it. I mean, I broke it into European commercial banks. For investment banking, I could not find enough investment banks in Europe because most investment banking in Europe is done by commercial banking firms. So there I had to go to the Anglo-Saxon world because that's where you see standalone investment banks. So I broke them down into two businesses. I got the levered betas of companies trading in each business, primarily in commercial banking, primarily in investment banking. I took the average levered beta. And then for Deutsche, I used the weighted average of the levered betas to come up with the levered beta for the company. Okay. That table up there is supposed to be the table giving you the breakdown. So what I've done is I've taken the levered beta of the two businesses, I took a weighted average of the levered betas and made it the levered beta for Deutsche. What's the step that I skipped here, which I did for Disney and for... So I took the levered betas, I took the average of the levered betas. Disney, did I use the levered betas of the businesses? I first unlevered the betas of the business, I took a weighted average and then applied Disney's debt to equity. I seem to be skipping those steps, right? And I always do with banks and financial service companies. And this is a pattern you're going to see. Whenever we talk about debt to equity for a bank, I'm going to throw up my hands and say, look, I'm not even going to try. Why is that? What is different about a bank that you should, when you think about debt, you know?
Debt is part of the business.
Debt is raw material for a bank, right? If you think about it, how do banks, think of an old-fashioned bank. What do? You borrowed money at 3%. So think of your deposits in the bank and what they're paying. You lent it out at 4.5%. You made money on the spread. Debt to a bank is not a source of capital. It's raw material. That's why talking about the debt to equity ratio for a bank is kind of nonsensical. We'll talk about can a bank have too little equity? That's a good question to ask. But debt to equity ratios, and I challenge you, pick up a bank's balance sheet and tell me how much debt JP Morgan is outstanding. You're going to give up after about, because everything is debt and nothing is debt. And because of that with banks, I basically stay with levered betas, take the weighted average, and I'm done. It makes your life a lot simpler, right? You're not unlevering and re-levering. You're treating all banks as equally risky. And there is a danger there. The danger, which you saw in 2008, is that not all banks are equally risky. We assume that because these banks are regulated, they can't get really risky, which turned out not to be true if the regulatory overlay is not that good. So we'll come back and address this question. But for the moment, none of you should be doing banks in the first place. If you're looking at a bank, stay with levered betas, take the average. You get different costs of equities for the two businesses, but it's going to be driven by the levered betas of these businesses. So we've talked about Disney, we've talked about Deutsche, Vale, Tata Motors, Baidu. You know the one business we haven't addressed, right? Bookscape, the privately owned bookstore in New York. So I'm going to set the table for how this process is going to play out for a private business. But remember, for a private business, what you lack is market prices. If you're saying the only way I get a beta is a regression, already you're done, right? Because you can't run a regression. I'm going to give you two pathways to getting a beta for a private business. One I almost never use, but I'll give it to you anyway because I've seen people use it. It's called an accounting beta. And the other is to use the process we use for Disney and Vale, which is a bottom-up beta, with a caveat. And the caveat will come quickly. So here's the setup. This privately owned bookstore in New York entered my landscape about 20 years ago. I was sitting in my office, lady knocks on the door. She comes in and she says, I hear you teach finance. I said, no, I teach marketing. I was trying to evade whatever question she had. She said, no, I know you teach finance. You're on the finance floor. I said, you got me. She said, I own this bookstore in New York City, which I inherited from my father, who inherited from his father. It's been in our family for three generations. And it's a bookstore that actually has a nice location and a nice long-term lease. And I need to do something. I said, "What? I know nothing about bookstores. What do you want to do?" She said, "A Barnes & Noble is opening down the street." At that time, remember, Barnes & Noble is this growing bookstore chain. And she said, to compete with them, we need to put a cappuccino bar and couches in this in our bookstore. And I said, "I still don't see why you're talking to me. I mean, I don't know how to design a cappuccino bar. Maybe you should walk into a Starbucks and see how it's done." She said, "No, no. To open this, make these investments, we have to take the rest of our wealth and put it into the bookstore. And we need to figure out how much of return we need." So in a sense, she wanted a hurdle rate, to which your question is, how the heck have you run your business for 70 years without a hurdle rate? But remember, if your grandfather started, great location, in a sense, the business had run itself. Nobody had ever had to think about making new investments. She said, "Can you help me come up with what we need to make on this money?" I said, "I guess I can." She gave me, I think, you know, a coupon for $100. I said, "Okay, I'll take it." It seemed not charitable to reject that gift. So I said, "I'll get back to you soon." So she's in a bookstore. So to get a bottom-up beta, what do I need? I need to find publicly traded bookstores, right? Finding private bookstores is not going to help me. I need a beta. So I went and looked up, I went and looked up publicly traded bookstores, and I ran into a bit of a problem. I found three. Three is not very good. So I started doing one of my tricks, which is going up and down the food chain. And I said, if bookstores do well, publishing companies are probably also doing well. I'm going to bring them into the mix. Ended up with a sample of about 10 firms. And I said, "Look, I'm getting a $100 coupon. I'm not spending any more time than this. So 10 is good enough." I took the betas for the companies. I did exactly what I did for Disney, and I came up with an unlevered beta for being in the book business. Notice I kind of subtly changed from bookstores to book business because it's across the book business of 0.76. So ignore the last two decimals. I'm almost there, right? What's the last step? Once you get an unlevered beta for a company, for Disney, once you got the unlevered beta for the operating businesses, what was the last thing we did? We needed debt to equity. But what's a debt and equity? They had to be market values, right? You see the problem with private companies? After you've got the unlevered beta for a private business, there is no market equity you can use. So I thought I would take the easy way out. I picked up the phone. I called the owner of the bookstore and I said, "Do you have a target debt to equity ratio?" She said, "A what?" Kind of answered my question. Because if she'd said my target debt to equity is 20%, I'd have just used it and moved on. I've almost never got an answer from a private business owner that I can actually use, except in the cases where the private business owner says, "I never borrow money." That would have made my life easy, right? Because then I'd use it. She said, "No, I don't have a target." I said, "Do you have a lease?" And she said, "Of course I have a lease." So here's what I did. I said, "Look, I cannot get a debt to equity ratio for the company directly, but I know what the debt to equity ratio for publicly traded companies is. And if you're in the same business, you should have roughly the same kind of exposure to debt." It's an assumption, but it's an assumption that lets me move on. I use the 21.41% debt to equity ratio of the book publicly traded book companies to come up with the levered beta. 0.86. Right? So I've done exactly what I did for Disney. But then I paused and said, if I use that beta to come up with the cost of equity, I come up with 7.5%. What am I assuming when I use beta as my measure of risk? That the marginal investor in the company is well diversified, right? What did this lady say she was going to do? Take the rest of her wealth and she's the exact opposite of diversified, right? And with private business owners, this is going to be the rule rather than the exception. How can you be diversified and own a private business at the same time? It sucks up all your money. So I have a question. If I use the beta to come up with the cost of equity for a private business where the owner is not diversified, am I going to underestimate that company's cost of equity or overestimate it? How many think I will underestimate the cost of equity? And why? Give me the intuitive reason. Why?
You underestimated.
Why? Why?
You don't have enough information.
No, it's not that I don't have enough. In fact, if I don't have enough information, I could both over or underestimate. Because I'm focusing only on the portion of the risk that I cannot diversify when I use betas. And we know that this lady is exposed to all of the risk, right? Which is going to be higher than the risk I focused on. You're going to underestimate the cost of equity for a private company if you take betas and plug them in, because you're missing that company-specific risk that would normally be diversified away, but this person's going to be exposed to. So at least we know the direction, which is good. I know the cost of equity has to be higher. So when I first started looking at private companies, I wanted to figure out how much higher. So I remember I was at a private appraiser conference, I think in, you know, somewhere in New Orleans. And I said, you know, you must deal with this problem all the time, right? As private company appraisers, what do you do? They said, we add 10%. And I said, what? I said, whatever you come up with as your cost of equity, we add 10%. We call it a company-specific risk premium. I said, that's nice, but where do you come up with the 10%? They all looked at it, it's here when I got here, and it's always been 10%. And I said, that doesn't work for me. Can't be 10% for every company, right? It should vary across companies. And I said, maybe there's a way I can estimate how much of the risk in the company comes from the market and how much comes from the firm. How am I going to do that? What can I look at that will tell me how much of the risk in the movie business comes from the market? See the R squared? Remember when we looked at R squared, what we said it measured, measures the proportion of the risk in a typical, in a company that comes in the market. The median R squared across book companies is 26%. So if I believe these regressions from which I'm getting the beta, 74% of the variance comes from the company, 26% comes.
Would you get the, like, the more accurate measure of say earnings and rest of the
guests. Okay, so let's look at the practical problems for that, right? That's an accounting beta, right? Let's take earnings. First, how many observations are you going to get for each year that you have data?
For each year?
At most four, right? And with private companies, you might get only one. So let's say your private company's been around 5 years. Monthly earnings? But what will I regress against, right? How would I estimate monthly earnings? You'd have income statements per month. Yeah. Usually with private businesses, they'll give you one finance because they can't pay the accountant to come in every month. Remember, they're not doing the accounting. They're hiring an accounting firm to do it. They'll give you the numbers on what their revenues are. So maybe I can use revenues. But here's also the other problem. What do accountants do to earnings? And they don't do it with bad intentions. They smooth out earnings. You notice this? Where they take an expense and spread it out over time. They're trying to be fair. And in the process, they're actually undercutting my objective of, can I look at earnings? And so that's called an accounting beta. I've estimated for the longest time, every company seems to have an accounting beta close to one because they smooth things up. So practically, I don't disagree with you. I would look at the revenues and the earnings, but it's very difficult to go from there to a beta. So the R squared from the regressions become my proxy for how much of the risk in a typical book company comes from the market. So let's complete the process. I have a market beta, right? Comes from looking at publicly traded companies. I also have the R squared of these companies. And here's a little statistical artifact. When you look at the R squared, it tells you the proportion of the variance in the company that is explained by the market. I know this is going to sound foreign, but a beta is a standard deviation concept. In fact, the way you compute beta is you take the standard deviation of the stock and you multiply with the covariance of the market. Everything is based, you're saying, so what? Standard deviation is the square root of the variance. So when you look at the R squared, you're actually looking at a measure that computes what the effect is on variance. But if you're looking at standard deviation, you should be looking at the square root of the R squared. And I won't insult you by asking you what it is. The square root of the R squared is obviously R, which is the correlation coefficient. So here's the way to think about it algebraically. 51% of the standard deviation, that's a square root of 0.26. 51% of the standard deviation. Let's make it 50, nice rounded number. Half the standard deviation in a typical book company is explained by the market. Half is due to company specific risk. What is the beta that I came up with for the half that was market for market risk? 0.86, right? So roughly speaking, what should be the beta that this owner sees in the company's risk if they're exposed to all of the risk? So think like an algebra problem, right? If I'm exposed to only half the risk, I'm demanding a beta of 0.86. If I'm exposed to all of the risk, my beta should be twice that number because I'm exposed to all of the risk. I'm basically expanding the beta to bring in the rest of the risk. In other words, I'm doing what analysts and appraisers claim to do, company-specific risk. I'm bringing into the beta. I call it a total beta. I concocted this measure, and I use that word deliberately. I didn't derive it, and there's no huge amount of theory behind it. Essentially, it's an extension of mean variance into private businesses. And it's a number I can compute for every business. So if you go to my website, there's a second data set. I told you there's a data set for betas by sector. I have a second one that gives you total betas by sector using the R-squareds. And they're going to be much higher than the regular beta. In some businesses, the difference is going to be wide because most of the risk comes from the company. In some businesses, like utilities, the difference is actually much smaller because most of the risk in those companies comes from the market. So in this case, I ended up with a total beta 1.68. Plugging in, I got a cost of equity of 11.98%. I rounded it up to 12%. I'd earned my $100 coupon. I called the lady and said, your cost of equity is about 12%. And then she asked me two questions. The first was easy to answer. The second I knew the answer to, but I couldn't think of a kind way to give it. The first question she asked me was, Barnes & Noble, publicly traded bookstores opening down the street, what's their cost of equity is going to look like? You know what the answer to that is, right? They're publicly traded. The only risk they care about is a risk you cannot diversify away. I said, it's going to be about 7.5%. That was the easy question, in case you're wondering. Then she asked me the second question, which is, if my cost of equity as a private business owner is 12%, and their cost of equity is only 7.5%, how the heck am I going to compete with these guys in the long term? And what's the honest answer to that question? You cannot. Over time, in almost every business, guess what happens? Publicly traded companies push out private businesses, not because private business owners are less hardworking. They're actually more hardworking, but because they're less efficient about risk taking. We'll talk about the niches private businesses are in, but let's take a couple of businesses that have been changed by this phenomenon. Now, 30 years ago, if you walked into a pharmacy in the US, you know, 80% of pharmacies in the US were independently owned. The pharmacist who stood behind the counter owned the pharmacy. Today, I challenge you to walk into any pharmacy in New York and then look up and you know what you're going to see, one or two names. You're going to see CVS or Duane Reade or maybe whatever. But every name you see is a publicly traded company. The pharmacy business has become almost entirely corporatized. People use this as an insult, but it's happened because the bookstore business, I mean, I'm not giving when Harry met Sally, but you know, you see the movie, you see the phenomenon fighting against, you can make them evil if you want. But the reality is the bookstore business essentially saw this transition. And now, of course, Barnes & Noble and other bookstores are driven out by Amazon. So this is, you know, what Joseph Schumpeter called, you know, creative destruction that happens with capitalism. It happens over. You look at business after business, you'll see public companies push out private. Which, if you're a private business owner, leaves you with a sense of how the heck do I survive? You know what? You got to find a niche that public companies cannot meet. There's a mystery bookstore in New York City. I'll give you the address if you're interested. It's a great bookstore. You walk in, it's only mystery books. So how does the owner survive? The owner's read every single book in the bookstore. So you walk up to the owner and said, I really like, you know, this author. She says, have you tried these three authors? So think of this as before Amazon book recommendations, an individual giving you book recommendations. Amazon book recommendations come from a computer algorithm. So person. Survive because if you like mystery books and you try that at Barnes & Noble, you walk up to the cashier and say, can you give me some suggestions on books? She probably says, look, I've never read a book. Why are you asking me? There's a big Harry Potter pile in the front. Why don't you take one and leave? Right? So you've got to find a way to make your private business niche unique enough that they come to you. But you can see it's a fight against forces that are really powerful. So I will leave it to that. Wednesday, we will talk about cost of debt and cost of capital. And one more thing, I'm sorry. There is a case on your that's due at the end of this month. That case will be available after class today for you to download. So I would suggest you download it. I know the break is coming, so you might not be able to work on it, but at least read it so you have a sense of what needs to get done. Yeah, I think I'll be fine.